It almost appears what you're doing with this plan is just covering your backside because you don't know what's going to happen.
State lawmakers hear about the difficult task of halibut allocation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Labor Day, Monday, September 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state works to get better reporting on firearm injuries.
There is a disproportionate number of firearm injuries among males, Black and Alaska Native people.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
A 39-year-old man is in custody after he tried to rush the exit door of an Alaska Airlines jet as it was taxiing to a gate at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. Airport spokesman Perry Cooper says passengers and the crew had to subdue the man today, who was apparently anxious to get off the plane. One crew member was bitten in the arm during the scuffle and was taken to Highline Medical Center in Buren, Washington for treatment of minor injuries. The man was taken to Highline for a medical health evaluation before being transferred to King County Jail. He was expected to be booked on investigation of felony assault. Flight 108 from Anchorage landed in Seattle at about 4:30 this morning. Cooper says no other airport operations were affected. Two planes flown by lone commercial pilots who were friends collided outside of Nightmute Friday evening. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating. A Cessna 208 belonging to Grant Aviation plunged to the tundra and burned, taking the life of Scott Veal, age 24, of Kenai. The other plane was a 207 belonging to Ryan Air. It was piloted by Kristen Sprague, age 26. She was able to land on the tundra despite severe wing damage from the collision. NTSB investigator Clint Johnson says the two pilots were in touch by radio. Sprague was flying to Bethel from Tinunak, and Veal was flying to Bethel from Tuksuk Bay. Johnson said yesterday that pilot Sprague lost track of the other plane shortly before it struck her plane's right wing, about 800 feet above ground. It was the state's third mid-air crash since July. The state epidemiology office is looking to expand the way it gathers information on firearm injuries throughout the state. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
A new state study shows that African Americans and Native males and those living in the northern and southwestern parts of the state have the highest rates of firearm deaths and injury. The epidemiology report looks at a five-year span between 2003 and 2008. Deborah Holjilly is one of the authors.
What we did find is that there is a disproportionate number of firearm injuries among males. They're higher among males, Black and Alaska Native people, and also persons living in the northern and southwest regions.
Alaska Native and American Indians had the highest rates of firearm deaths at 28.3 per 100,000. Black males had the highest rates of firearm hospitalizations at 41.6 per 100,000. However, the study doesn't include all firearm injuries. It does not include outpatient and emergency room data if no hospitalization was needed. If that information was included, Holjilly says, the numbers would be higher.
One of the areas that we have a lack of information on is through our mandatory firearm reporting system.
That system requires all healthcare providers to report all firearm injuries to epidemiology. And soon, Holjilly says, that information will be available.
We are revamping that firearm surveillance system so that we can get report from all healthcare providers. We're looking at reports by not only hospitals and ambulatory care facilities, but also EMS, any way that we can get the information about a firearm injury, whether it's treated on site or received no treatment per se, and then those that are transported to the hospital.
She adds that the new reporting database not only looks at traditional forms of firearms like shotguns and handguns, but other types of guns like paintball guns, BB guns, and air rifles.
So it would give us a much clearer picture of what injuries are happening, what are the activities, and how we can foster prevention and control of these injuries.
The Epidemiology Office hopes to launch the new Firearm Surveillance System database January 1st, 2012. Holjilli says this new information should help agencies like law enforcement and prevention groups get a clearer picture of how to respond to high-risk areas and people. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Legislators took a lesson in fish management and politics late last week, and they got a chance to show their frustration with the federal government's restrictions on South Central and Southeast halibut harvests. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Everyone agreed there is a need to protect the state's halibut resources. All the legislators, federal and state managers, and representatives of charter and commercial fishing groups most affected by the upcoming changes. They also agreed with a federal decision to extend by 15 days the public comment period on the proposed halibut catch-sharing plan. That extension was announced by Glenn Merrill with the National Marine Fisheries Service. He says the goal is to make any needed final changes based on the new comments. That'll get the plan before the International Pacific Halibut Commission in November, publication of a final rule in December, and another commission meeting in January where final action will take place.
If the catch-sharing plan final rule is available and the IPHC makes specific recommendations on management measures that would affect the charter fleet, those would be implemented through the annual management measure process. So the IPHC will make the recommendation in January, and then in March we will actually implement that through a regulatory process.
But the praise and thanks for the extension marked the end of camaraderie. In its current form, the new management plan could force further restrictions on charter sport fishing operators and commercial operators, cutting the catch limits from 2 to 1 fish in some charter places and from 37 inches to 32 inches maximum limit on others. It could also cut the commercial operators by restricting their allocations. Anchorage Republican Craig Johnson pushed for more information. He saw the need to protect the resource, but he wanted to know how the plan had been developed without any economic studies having been done.
It almost appears what you're doing with this plan is just covering your backside because you don't know what's going to happen. And you recognize that in doing that, you're going to have a tremendous economic impact on Alaska.
Johnson said he doesn't see how any management decisions could be made in good conscience without economic data.
If you make this decision, I don't think you've done due diligence. And I think you've done a disservice to the state of Alaska, to the citizens, my constituents, the constituents in Southeast, everywhere, as well as the resource. Unless you have that information, you're making your decisions in a vacuum.
Charter operators say the federal and international managers are going too fast. Heath Hilliard, the executive director of the Southeast Guides organization, said it's science. The commission needs to look at the impact of reduced harvests from this summer's operations, then make a final decision. Hilliard explained that charter guides do not sell fish, they sell opportunity. But with the size restrictions now on them, clients have nothing to work for.
Many charter clients are looking for the opportunity to catch a trophy fish and are satisfied when they catch something smaller. But when you tell clients or potential clients that they can't catch anything larger than 37 inches, the demand and effort are greatly diminished. It's a bit analogous to going to Las Vegas to gamble and being told that if you win the big jackpot, you can keep a quarter of it or have to give it back entirely.
Over the past half decade, commercial fishermen have seen their individual shares plummet with annual reductions in the amount of halibut they're allowed to harvest. Mark Vinsel, the executive director of the United Fishermen of Alaska, said the new regulations for charter fishermen are overdue. He says the plan meets three simple goals.
Establishes a clear allocation between charter and longline sectors, sharing the burden of conservation. It establishes a responsive management system with proactive accountability measures to prevent annual catch limit overages. And it provides a mechanism for transfer of quota from the commercial to the charter sector.
Legislators will have no direct input into the decisions to be made this winter, But Wenzel said quick action is the best way to avoid putting at risk the sustainability of the halibut resource. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new Smithsonian art exhibit examines climate change impacts on Indigenous people.
Permafrost is melting under it. It's not standing up straight anymore, a lot of trees.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
John Hoover, a revered artist in Alaska who used imagery and tales from Native traditions in contemporary works, has died at 91. Hoover's work was shown around the world and was prized by collectors, corporations, and museums. His wife Mary confirmed his death on Saturday in Washington State, where they lived on Puget Sound. Hoover was born in Cordova and for years worked as a fisherman. He told the newspaper in 1998 he turned to art after building a 58-foot fishing vessel in the late 1950s, and it made him realize what he had done was much like sculpture. In 2002, the Anchorage Museum held a retrospective of his work. In May, the University of Alaska Anchorage awarded him an honorary doctorate. A federal judge in Anchorage is giving prosecutors more time to decide whether to call a key figure in the corruption retrial of former state lawmaker Vic Coring. U.S. District Judge Ralph Beislein granted a request by prosecutors, giving them until September 30th to make arrangements for travel to New Mexico to meet with Allen. Allen was chairman of a now-defunct oil field services company who pleaded guilty to bribery and tax violations in a corporation probe that ensnared Alaska politicians, including Vic Coring. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage has taken over the corruption retrials of both Coring and Pete Cott. Last month, several Justice Department attorneys from Washington, D.C. withdrew from the Cott and Coring cases. The attorneys said in court papers that they had not been involved in the cases since the convictions of Cott and Coring were overturned and new trials were ordered earlier this year. The Anchorage office had been recused from a corruption investigation that ensnared Alaska politicians in the late 2000s to avoid potential conflicts of interest. Kevin Fieldus, chief of the office's criminal division, said the recusal has been lifted. Early numbers indicate enrollment is up this fall at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Preliminary figures peg Fairbanks campus enrollment at more than 5,100, up 61 students from this time last year. University spokeswoman Marmion Grimes says numbers have yet to settle out, but the trend is toward an uptick.
We do believe we will be up fairly significantly this year. Anything above 3% is good growth. We're seeing growth in our science, technology, engineering, and math areas. Those units combined at this point are up about 4.2% over last year at the same time.
Grimes says growth in natural sciences may be tied to the $88 million life sciences facility currently under construction.
Over history, enrollment growth actually follows capital growth. So as we have, you know, we bring new facilities online or refurbish existing ones, the enrollment increases actually follow that. So we're hoping that as we bring life sciences online, we'll continue to see growth in some of those science areas as well.
Grimes says if you look at UAF system-wide and include five rural campuses and distance education programs, enrollment is currently at 7,890, an over 6% increase from last year. But she stresses numbers are not finalized until later in the month. University of Alaska Anchorage system early enrollment is at more than 18,300, up 1.9% compared to this time last year. The Juneau Economic Development Council has taken its show on the road. The council does what it calls gap financing, putting up the money to help start up businesses. KCAW's Ed Ronco has the story.
Tony Field has an idea.
I'm considering and hoping to start up a bowling center here in Sitka. I know there's been a lack of since I've been here, and the prior bowling center closed just prior to me getting here in 2006.
Bowling Sitka used to have a bowling alley, doesn't anymore, and Field believes the city could use one. But he says there are obstacles.
It's going to take a lot of money. Money is obviously the driving force. And there are several different options with that. And hopefully in the near future, I'll be starting to pursue those avenues.
Field was in the audience at the Greater Sitka Chamber of Commerce's weekly luncheon on Wednesday, where he and others heard a presentation from the Juneau Economic Development Council. It included a long list of resources for small business operators, banks, state loan programs, and more, but also details about what the nonprofit calls gap funding, loans to help first-time business people get started to make a good impression on private lenders. The funding comes from economic disaster relief money set aside to help Southeast deal with the decline of the timber industry in the late 1990s.
Quite a lot of it went into different communities, and we got a grant from the CBJ, Juneau, City and Borough of Juneau, to set up revolving loan funds.
Margaret O'Neill is director of the Revolving Loan Fund for the Juneau Economic Development Council.
We had initially one for Juneau, two for Sitka, one for Wrangell, one for Haines, one for Thorne Bay. And then JEDC borrowed $1 million from the USDA to do a region-wide loan program.
O'Neill says that the region-wide loan program can make loans anywhere in Southeast except Juneau. And after her chamber presentation, O'Neill said helping startups, start up, is one of the best parts of her job.
People are pursuing their passions, or they, you know, maybe have inherited some money or something like that, and now they want to figure out if they can do what they always wanted to do. But I guess the people I've spoken to so far haven't been in business for themselves. They've had day jobs and careers, and starting a business and being responsible for all of the financial aspects of it are daunting sometimes. So.
O'Neill's visit was sponsored by the Chamber and by the Sitka Economic Development Association. Chamber Executive Director Jennifer Robinson says people with optimism about the local business climate walk into her office a lot.
So I think that it is something that there are quite a few people looking into doing that. At how many of them go somewhere, we'll see. But there's definitely an interest in that still. So people must feel optimistic that this is still a good place to be starting a business.
Tony Field, the potential bowling center owner, says he's one of those optimists, hoping that economic recovery will happen sooner rather than later, and believing that regardless, Sitkins are ready and willing to spend their money on strikes and spares. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
A 3-year-old Fairbanks girl was treated in Anchorage over the weekend after suffering a gunshot wound. The child was seriously injured Friday afternoon at an apartment building in South Fairbanks. Emergency personnel flew the child to Anchorage by medevac. The girl's condition has not been released.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
We all need energy to power our homes and businesses. Tapping renewable energy sources like wind, geothermal, and hydro helps keep our economy local, creating jobs, revenue, and power for the state. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by Renewable Energy Alaska Project, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska.
Last week, members of the Wrangell Cooperative Association, Master Carvers, and Tlingit Elders gathered at Chief Shakes Island in Wrangell to bless the totem poles before restoration work got started. KSTK's Charlotte Duren has more on the ceremony and the next stages for the project.
Master Carver Wayne Price was at the ceremony and says it's an important start to the project with a purpose to honor the totems and their history in Wrangell.
Part of the history is to let them know, as if I would let you know, that, we're going to take you down, we're going to repair you, we're going to make you all better again, and then we're going to put you back up. So it's kind of just being aware of what totems mean to us and what's going to be happening. Usually the totem was put up and it didn't come down until it fell down.
The totem poles will be lowered by cranes and gently placed onto cribbing, and later tarps will be placed over the poles to protect them from the elements. Price says a great deal of preservation work will be done to the totem poles before they are put back up.
And we'll be able to let it dry out so we can get all the moss and all the trees and repair the spots that we can, and and give it a real good facelift, and then put some wood preservative on it and put some fresh paint on it and then get it ready to put back up.
Price says restoration work like this is somewhat new to Wrangell and looks forward to the process. And across town, the Wrangell Cooperative Association is hard at work planning for the next stages of the project.
What keeps me going is they're going to look a lot better, you know, when they go back up next summer.
That's WCA Grants Administrator Tis Peterman. Peterman has been working for over a decade to acquire grant funding for the project, which this year has reached close to $700,000. But even with all the excitement surrounding the project, she says for many in the community, watching the totem poles come down is a hard thing to see. But she says she's excited for the final result.
We've been in the planning stages for so long that, number one, to say, you know, this is actually happening, but number two, I grew up with those down there, you know, they've always been there my whole entire life, and to see them being brought down just sort of, it worries me, you know, because I always have the greatest fear that once we take everything apart, do we have enough money to put it back together? So it's sort of emotional when we're talking about it, but we know that we have several good funding sources out there that are watching this from all over the state, so we're excited about putting them back up and getting them.
The WCA has recently hired local Joy Prescott to document the entire restoration process, which will include updates on the WCA website and Facebook page. The restoration of Chief Shake's house is expected to be completed by August of 2012, and Peterman says at that point a celebration will be held to honor all those who contributed in the restoration process. I'm Charlotte Duran.
From Ethiopia to the Himalayas to Alaska, indigenous people are experiencing the effects of a changing climate. The Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian is sharing their experiences in an exhibit called Conversations with the Earth. And it includes photos and stories from Alaska's Arctic Village. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
French photographer Nicolas Villaume traveled far to take the pictures in the Smithsonian exhibit Conversations with the Earth. His stops included Brazil, Peru, and India. But one of the most unique places, he says, was Arctic Village on the border of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
When you look it on the map, it's a long way. It's fantastic. It's beautiful. It's nature, you know. State of nature.
Villaume documented the local ecosystems of 15 tribal communities in more than a dozen countries and how people are coping with climate change.
The whole idea of Conversation with the Earth is to try to bring the voices and to bring conversations to the other people. So that's why in some moments also we do some recordings of the voices. So it's all dealing with proximity of people, trust, and they explain what they see, what they experience.
One of the Alaskans profiled is Gwich'in leader Sarah James. The exhibit shows a big close-up portrait of her looking directly into the camera and at the viewer through her thin glasses. Silvery hair frames her face. You can also hear her story in her own words by pressing a button near the photo. James was recently in Washington for the exhibit's opening and said she likes the way the global exhibit comes together.
As a whole, it's very nicely done, and the story along with it is really, really good, because as you go into the exhibit, it just goes on and how these people see the climate change and global warming, how it's affecting them, and they always looking at a solution too. I thought that was really good when they're looking at solution.
One photo shows the grand winter landscape of Arctic Village, dotted in the foreground with leaning trees.
They call it a drunken tree in Alaska because a lot of permafrost is melting under it. It's not standing up straight anymore, a lot of trees.
Nicolas Villaume had some adventures getting the pictures, like going out on a caribou hunt. One photo shows Gwich'in hunter Jimmy John warming himself by the fire at his winter camp. The embers crackle and snowflakes pop in the foreground. You can feel how cold it is. A nearby tent glows, lit from within against the dark blue sky.
I grew up living in that kind of wall tent, we call it. And we put a little stove in there. You'll see it later in sight. We cook in there. But if it's really cold, like they were out 30 below, that means his back is pretty cold, but front is warm. That's what it is right now.
And the problem, I remember, is it's very hot when you put some wood, but in the middle of the night, then no wood's burning, and then you're freezing, and you wake up with some ice around you. Mm-hmm. Those guys are tough. Me, I'm a Frenchman, so it was stronger, but it was really a great experience.
And despite the cold of late winter in Arctic Village, Viome found warmth.
The heart of the people, they keep you warm, and the caribou meat also keep you warm. I mean, you eat caribou meat in the morning, in the afternoon, and the night. It's very nutritive. It's a big stuff.
The Gwich'in call themselves the caribou people, and they say their way of life and the caribou on which they survive are threatened by climate change. As lakes dry up, plant life dies, and the caribou may change their migration patterns. So the Arctic Village community opened itself up to Nicolas Viome and his camera as a way to spread the word. In total, he documents six ecosystems in the Smithsonian exhibit. Another is the Zanskari people in the Himalayas, who've become, in Viome's words, climate refugees as they move in search of fresh water.
And the problem over there is the glacier are melting, and the community have to change their traditional village. They have to abandon their traditional village to settle in other places. So imagine all the changes in mind, in the way of behaving, and the way of knowing your environment. You have to move and adapt. It's kind of climate refugee in a way. You know, it's going to be more and more like that.
Viome says it's important to him as a photographer not to just take from his subjects, so he shared the photos with them. And the indigenous communities are equal partners in the exhibit. All of them hope he's not documenting a way of life that's on its way out. They hope instead that it's capturing a moment in their stories of survival. Conversations with the Earth is on display at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian until January. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Charlotte Duran in Wrangell. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.